You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education podcast special, in which we'll be discussing the 2014 THE World Reputation Rankings. It's a definitive list of the world's 100 most prestigious universities based on the largest invitation-only survey of senior academics. Essentially, it's universities being judged by a very large jury of their peers. My name's Chris Parr. I'm a reporter on THE and I'm joined by rankings editor Phil Beatty. Phil, why did we launch these reputation rankings back in 2011, and what makes them such an important lead table for the world's leading universities?
Yeah, it was an interesting story, actually. We've been publishing the World University Rankings since 2004. We had many years of publishing the rankings, but there was quite a lot of interest in our blend of objective, hard data in the rankings and the use of subjective reputation surveys. In the main World University Rankings, we blend the two things together, and some of our advisors had said we'd like to see the subjective data in isolation. So I decided back in 2011 to publish it, actually just as a small feature in the magazine, more of as an academic exercise to say, what does it look like in isolation? But actually what we found was, I think because a university's brand, its reputation, even if that's subjective, is hugely important to its institutional standing, to its global positioning, you know, it's the way it brings in students, the way it brings in top faculty. It actually influences inward investment, it influences all aspects of a university. So actually we found this exercise, it was quite a modest feature, became a huge media phenomenon. The press went wild for it, it had masses of traffic, so it became an annual phenomenon. And I think the reason it's so important is that, you know, yes, we have to be clear, it's purely subjective opinion. It's just people's response to a survey saying who's the best. But actually, I think that is the key currency in higher education. You know, what are you without your academic reputation for, you know, excellence in teaching and research?
Absolutely. So it's, and it's also very pure in that sense, isn't it? It's not, you know, you can't manipulate it. It's simply what people have said when asked. And a lot of people asked as well, how many complete the survey?
This year's results are based on 10,000 responses, 10,500 usable responses. But the good thing is it's a carefully controlled sample, so it's invitation only. We're going right across the world, 10 different languages, you know, 130 or so countries responded to this one across the discipline. So it's a great sample. They're all published academics. But yeah, I think it works very well because it is what it is. You know, with the world rankings, there's all sorts of alchemy around the different weightings of the different indicators. But this one is purely who's the best, judged by the peers, judged by people who really understand excellence in teaching and research in our universities.
Sure, well, let's cut to the chase. I'll run through the top 10 institutions now, since that's probably what everyone's most interested in. Harvard's at the top, MIT number 2, Stanford 3, University of Cambridge is at 4, the University of Oxford is at 5, University of California, Berkeley is 6, at 7 is Princeton, at 8 is Yale, 9 California Institute of Technology, which is the World University Rankings number 1, of course, and number 10 UCLA. One thing that leaps out straight away is the US dominates that list, and you know, 8 out of the top 10 from that country, and Oxbridge completing the set. It's the US and the UK, isn't it, that have the most institutions in the top 100?
Yeah, I mean, actually, funnily enough, this is the first year we had a purely US-UK top 10. Most years in the past, we've had Tokyo in there as well. Mm-hmm. The University of Tokyo, it fell out this year for the first time, which is a blow to Tokyo, perhaps a natural result of the sort of shifting sands in higher education. But yeah, the US actually is incredibly dominant. It has 46 of the top 100. As you say there, it's got the top 3 positions, 8 of the top 10. I mean, it is actually staggering how much the US dominates these rankings. But the UK comes in a pretty healthy second place with 10 of the top 100 positions.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I picked upon in the piece that's in the magazine this week, though, is that even though the UK is in second place in terms of overall numbers in the top 100, it could be said to be suffering something of a reputational decline. It had 12 institutions in the list in 2011. It's now down to 10. And there's a bit of a changing demographic of universities as well. They seem to be concentrated more in the same region.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a clear sense that actually of our 10 top 100 universities in the UK. Actually, eight of them are from London in the southeast. If you include the sort of the Golden Triangle, you've effectively got six from London, and then Oxford and Cambridge in the Golden Triangle. So I think there's a very, very exciting, good story for London in the southeast. You know, a world centre for higher education excellence, more of the world's best or most prestigious universities than any other city, you know, trouncing Cambridge, Massachusetts, trouncing Paris and some of these other world centres of education. But I think a big issue for the UK is it seems to be more and more a question of London in the southeast. We've seen this year the University of Bristol has been slipping this year. It finally slipped out of the top 100 altogether. Mm-hmm. And the last couple of years, we lost the University of Leeds and we lost the University of Sheffield over 2013 and 2012. And also this year, we've actually seen Manchester slip just outside the top 50. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a bit of a concern about the fact that the UK's regions seem to be suffering. You know, is it about the concentration of wealth in the southeast? But certainly in terms of international prestige, international faculty, international students, London is the place to be, which is wonderful for the UK, but there is a more worrying sense that what about the regions and how important it is for them to sustain top-class universities, to make sure there's still inward investment and still talent being drawn into the regions as well.
It's not only HE, of course, where that centralisation appears to be happening, and big sort of red brick institutions as well, Sheffield's, your Leeds, your Bristol's. The UK, I'd imagine, would be a little worried to see those kind of stalwarts falling out of that list.
Yeah, I think it speaks to this wider concern about, you know, the way the economy's going, the way the housing situation's going. There is this problem that, you know, jobs growth is in the southeast, all the economic growth is in the southeast, the property issues around the southeast. I think there's a problem because having world-class universities in a region is essential to their economic strength. As I say, they become magnets for international talent, innovation, you know, knowledge transfer, and there is a bit of a worry that perhaps we're betting all our horses or betting all our cash on the horses of London in the southeast. But having said that, a country of our size, we still punch above our weight, and we should be still pleased that we have some of the most prestigious universities in the world by quite some distance.
Yeah, I mean, looking a bit further afield in Europe then, you mentioned Paris earlier. Two French institutions fall out of the top 100 this year, the Université Paris-Sud and École Polytechnique. But better for Germany, just over the border. Germany's had a good year.
Yeah, I think one of the issues with France, I think, is that they've become so obsessed with rankings, they're undergoing more reform. So there's actually, I think, a brand problem with France, that there's so many historical names, but there's lots of change to the structures, lots of uncertainty around exactly who you're dealing with in France. You know, a highly complex system, certainly in Paris. Whereas in Germany, I think we have seen perhaps the effects of the Excellence Initiative. You know, Germany has sustained funding to its universities quite well. There has been a bit more selective funding. There may be a problem in the UK that we've focused too much of our cash and resources on London is actually helping Germany. There's been much more of a sort of concerted effort to reward the best to compete at the world-class level. Mm. And then maybe Germany's been helped by a more concentration of funding, but a general weathering of the storm in terms of austerity that's hit other parts of Europe.
Yeah, it has gained a top 100 entrant this year, Germany taking it up to six. Elsewhere in Europe, the Netherlands are quite a strong performer too. They've got four top 100 players. What's the picture over there?
I think one of the things that's always struck me about the Netherlands is that they've had this incredible strength in depth, but they've always worried about not having any single outstanding flagship. So they've talked a lot about merging institutions to try and have a world top 50, but they've actually had quite a strong equal system, and in some respects maybe the equality of the system, that excellence is spread across the 13 research intensive universities in the Netherlands, maybe means that they struggle to have any particularly outstanding elite group because of the more equal system. But they do actually have a player that has popped into the top 50 for the first time. Delft University of Technology has managed to rise into the top 50. So it's a kind of complex picture in the Netherlands, but in generally, again, punching well above their weight in the rankings.
Mm. I was looking back to 2013, the coverage last year. The big success story then was Australia, which had six institutions in the top 100, which was up from four in 2012. They've slipped a little bit this year. Monash drops out, and only the University of Melbourne makes the top 50, whereas they had three in that bracket last year. I suppose that's a nice way to kick off the Asia-Pacific region as a discussion. I mean, what's the picture over there?
Yeah, it was a collective blow for the whole of Australia, actually, this year, that all of their institutions took a bit of a hit. I think Monash was a bit of a cruel one. It's actually outside the top 100 by just a couple of places. Mm. But symbolically, it's hit that cutoff point. It's fascinating because, obviously, we can't speculate what people were thinking when they filled out these forms. All we can say for sure is fewer people mentioned the Australian universities when they're mentioning world-class higher education at the disciplinary level. But one of the things I would speculate about is that there was actually an announcement of absolutely huge funding cuts smack bang in the middle of our reputation survey.
Mm.
So the survey took place in March, April, May 2013, and the former government announced cuts of 2.3 billion Australian dollars right in April. So it would only be speculation because we don't know what the respondents were thinking, but that could easily have sent out a pretty poor message across the world that Australians were massively disinvesting in their education system. I think it's about 1.6 billion of UK pounds in cuts, unprecedented for around a decade in Australia. So that might have sent out a pretty seriously negative message around the world, but we can only speculate.
Yeah, and elsewhere in Asia, the strongest performer by distance is Japan. You mentioned not a great year for its flagship, Tokyo, which slipped out of the top 10, I think for the first time ever. But its peers doing better, Kyoto making the top 20, Osaka entering the top 50, Tokyo Institute of Technology rising from the 61 to 70 bracket to the 51 to 60. So success for Japan there, and obviously its rivalry, I guess, is to an extent with China and Hong Kong. What's the picture in that sort of area?
Yeah, I think Japan, I think, are still very much the dominant force in Asia-Pacific higher education. Tokyo's blow, it was only a couple of places it fell, marginal fall, but symbolically out of the top 10, still 11th in the world, very, very powerful. But actually, we had been concerned about the Japanese universities losing ground because they were increasingly isolated. They seemed to be a concern that, after their incredible boom in the sort of 40s and 50s, that they were losing a bit of ground. They were too introspective. They weren't international enough. They weren't networked enough globally. But it would appear that over the last couple of years, government initiatives to try and encourage international recruitment, encourage international student exchange, has possibly helped them maintain their position, strengthen their position. And they are still clearly seen collectively as among the very, very best universities in the region. China's had a mixture. Tsinghua and Peking, only two universities make the top 100. But Tsinghua is pretty stable in 36th, and they're both in the top 50. Hong Kong, a very mixed picture. University of Hong Kong seems to be slowly losing a lot of ground, but actually other sort of more lean and dynamic and specialist institutions doing well. Hong Kong UST has had another good year rising up the table. So a mixed picture, but generally I think it is fair to say that Tokyo and Tsinghua and some of the leading Asian universities are still holding firm, making reasonably good inroads into this very Western-dominated table.
Mm, South Korea doing well this year too, gains an extra representative, Yonsei University, jumping straight into the 81 to 90 band. But let's look, I mean, there's a supplement produced to accompany these results. We can't cover them all in this podcast. Do make sure you have a read of that. Some great writers, some great articles. What are some of the highlights from the supplement that you will find with this week's Times Higher Education?
I think one of the highlights of the supplements is we have the president of MIT writing for us,
and he's really talking about the pioneering of MOOCs and digital education by MIT. It's really interesting that MIT and Harvard were the ones who came together to create edX, and they're the sort of top two. They're really amazing global brands, but very willing to push that brand out into the wider world and really see many, many tens of thousands of people sampling their courses and getting a taste of what they offer. But the supplement's got quite a lot of articles in there. We have full results analysis. We have the methodological breakdown. We have articles about building brands. Anne Pakir, who is the Director of International Relations at the National University of Singapore, which is another university who's been creeping up quite consistently over time, she's talking about the strategic importance of international collaboration. So they obviously have the famous Yale NUS institution for liberal arts, which was really exciting. They have the Duke NUS medical facility. So, you know, NUS's strategy has been about choosing big, important partners to collaborate on joint projects with. And of course, they've got a lot of money to draw in these great partners. So lots of material in there, lots of analysis and discussion.
Yeah, Glyn Davis, VC at the University of Melbourne, which we mentioned earlier, also writes in there. So very much worth checking out. You'll get all of the results online at timeshighereducation.co.uk/world-university-rankings, or you can just go to timeshighereducation.co.uk and click the rankings tab. You can also follow our rankings account on Twitter at @theworlduni_rank. That's all one word. If you do have any comments that you'd like to make about any of the articles in that supplement or any of the results this year, do get in touch. But that's all for this special Times Higher Education World Reputation Rankings podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.